This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good, all is well.
Fantastic. All right, we got a few questions that have to do with introverts, extroverts, and then we're going to get on to some more other questions. So we're just going to hit the ground running.
All right, that's good.
Dear Dr. Lyle, can someone who's usually very extroverted avoid people and situations because they do not want to display a status change? I've noticed that since putting on weight that I'm more of a homebody, and I wonder if it's the shame keeping me inside because I don't want negative esteem signals from others who notice this weight gain.
Well, of course. Okay, so a very honest, open question and self-assessment. Let's go back and explain a little bit about personality just kind of briefly, and that is that if we call you extroverted, that's because that's a description of how it is that you are different than other people. And that what that means is that relative to the average person, you are more outgoing, overall. If we were to look at 250 different types of situations, we would find that you would be chirping up more than other people. You'd be making more eye contact. You'd be closing the distance between people. More words would be said by you, et cetera. And you would be asking more questions. You would be causing more social interaction than the average person. Now, that's just a general overall characteristic that is, if we looked at you across thousands of situations, we would find that you would have a score on a bell curve. And so other people, if they all had very similar looking situations to you, we would find that their scores, the average person's score, would be lower. So maybe you caused, an average of 1,757 words per conversation, and they caused 942 words per conversation. And it turns out that out of 1,000 opportunities for those possibilities, you had 677 interactions, and the average person had 341. So these are quantitative variations that are in your genetic code that cause you to be more social than the average person. That's an overall orientation towards the threats and opportunities that are involved in social interaction. Not just threats, but also costs. In other words, the entire thing is simply a cost-benefit of an analysis. Now, however, cost-benefit analyses aren't run in a vacuum. Quite the opposite. They're run in an entirely integrated package of all values of your life. So all things being equal, if you've just had you have some embarrassing display of a status loss, either weight, or you just lost a job, or you've been divorced, or your kid just got thrown in prison. In other words, there would be any number, or you took a second place in some contest and everybody thought you were going to take first. So any possible way that you could be losing status and it would be publicly observable and known is going to cause you to not want to be in the public eye, obviously. Okay, so maybe it's not so obvious, but you can see why that would be true, and particularly with respect to having gained a bunch of weight. So you're going to be essentially trying to not be seen until you can do something about it. And so your extroversion is still your extroversion, but it's running its computations about what's in your best interest through a dynamic filter of cost-benefit analyses. And in this case, it's telling you, hey, better stay hidden for a while and see if we can sort this thing out.
All right. Well, on the other side, Dr. Lyle, I feel that I often get ignored in social groups and don't get the basic mm-hmm. respect given to most people. For example, mm-hmm. even in an academic setting, many people are allowed to go on long, rambling rants. But as soon as I mm-hmm. take a breath after a pause, someone steps in, mm-hmm. and I often begin the same sentence three times before giving up because I'm talked over. I'm quite sure it's not because I have nothing of value to add. I'm quite introverted. Mm-hmm. But I don't know mm-hmm. what verbal and nonverbal cues that I'm leaking that make other people think it's their best move to step over me.
Yeah, interesting. So likely to be a female. And if you're and likely to be an agreeable female, probably that is reasonably pleasant, not particularly assertive, no indication that she's going to be penalizing anybody for doing this. And so in a pack of hyenas that everybody's trying to get the floor to show off, obviously more aggressive individuals, more disagreeable individuals are going to be likely to, essentially be savoring the opportunity to open up their own mouths and try to get a bunch of status. So if our quiet, relatively introverted, pleasant individual is not signaling any costs associated with those interruptions, then this is likely to continue as long as you're in those situations. So does the individual ask what they're supposed to do about it? Maybe not.
I can't
remember the question.
Yeah, she's just saying that she gets ignored. I'm assuming she wants to know what she can do about it. She just wants to know if she's leaking any verbal and nonverbal cues.
Oh, right. Yeah, you're leaking. Yeah, she's leaking cues. She's leaking cues of pleasant individual. And a pleasant individual is not going to impose costs on anybody. So there would be, if it's the same individuals, for example, let's suppose that it's who knows, this is an academic setting. It sounds like a student. So if the student's in a situation where a bunch of other students are desperately trying to signal their dominance for various and sundry outcomes, then she doesn't have as much on the line. The sounds odd, and it would sound even sexist, but generally that would be the case. So for example, for a male desperate to climb a dominance hierarchy, it's more important that they muscle their way to the top of that hierarchy. And if they have to step on a few necks to get there, oh well. Okay. So if this is a female writer, it's likely that it's not, even though it may be very important to her, it's likely to be not as important to her as it is to the disagreeable individuals who are doing this. So the problem with this, ultimately, is that we have a bad dominance hierarchy at the top, that we have someone who's in charge that is letting this go. Okay, so your real problem is really not a problem with you. It's a problem with leadership. And so that problem is, although it's transient, it's likely to be recurrent in your life. In other words, there'll be times and places across your life where this is likely to happen. And every different situation would call for a slightly different solution as to how to handle it. Okay. So if it was a recurrent set of people, then you could literally go to, for example, the one of the more agreeable, pleasant, but assertive people, and you could try to form a coalition with them. And you could say to them, for example, I really appreciate a lot of things that you say, and I think you have a lot of good things to say. However, one thing that is uncomfortable for me is sometimes I have, once in a while I have something to say as well. And I feel like I have a hard time getting the floor or keeping it. And I feel like, you and others that are more assertive kind of talk over the top of me. So I know you probably don't mean anything by it, and you do have a lot to say. But, I'd appreciate it if in the future you just might pause a little bit and give me a little space. I'm not going to take up the floor forever, but I just want to get my words out, and it's not easy for me. If you do that, then you wind up with a champion in there that isn't going to let anybody else do it either. And that you let them, you don't need to bark once you own a dog. And so that would be a technique. That would be a technique for essentially getting yourself an ally, at which point you become much tougher. So that would be one solution to one particular configuration, but there would be others. But the fundamental problem that the person is having is a lack of leadership and organization in the guiding force there. And, so oftentimes they'll be in better situations, but a lot of situations are like that. And so a lot of times if it's necessary, we have to do some of the social engineering to have better outcomes for ourselves. And that would be one. Another would be to go to whoever's ostensibly in leadership and go to them privately and say, listen, I know that there's a lot of people have a lot of interesting things to say. I don't have a lot to say, but when I do, I'd really appreciate that if I could have the floor. So I feel like the barbarians are at the gates. And, I know they're smart, but they're five times more assertive than I am. And I feel like my thinking is just as good as theirs. And I feel like, when I'm ready to speak up, I'd appreciate a little bit of support. Okay? I.e., you frickin' worthless lack of backbone flake who has let this go in a way that it shouldn't. But we do it nicely and pleasantly, and then we try to stick a ramrod up the quasi-alpha spine so that they can do something about it. That's another way to do it.
Fascinating. If I could get a time machine and go back, a couple of decades ago and watch you in college, Dr. Lyle, I think it would be really fun.
All right, let's go ahead.
All right. All right, dear Dr. Lyle, here we have, you said the animal in the zoo problem. Dear Dr. Lyle, I do not feel depressed, but I am painfully prone to passivity. I often feel that I'm not doing anything with my life, but any episodes of inspiration or motivation only last for a minute or two. I don't have any financial troubles, so perhaps I lack pressure from my life. But I don't know how I could create pressure.
Wow. What a first world problem. Yeah, I kind of don't have any stress. Kind of don't have any goals that are a little bit outside of my reach, so I don't really have to move around in my chair too much because I can pretty much reach them all. Well, my friend, you've got enough natural social support and enough intelligence and enough capability and enough knowledge, and have secured yourself in secure enough circumstances that you get to exercise effectively the energy conservation machinery inside the system. And that's what you're doing, and it's genetic. So you can't talk ambition into anybody. Can't do it. This is just how it is. I may not tell the story quite right, but there was a 7'2" center that played, I think, in the 1980s, and he, maybe early 90s, he had enormous potential. He was strong as an ox. He was athletic. But I don't think he was really that serious about making the most of his potential. His name was Tito Horford. And The you know, you could just see the general managers in the NBA just drooling over Tito Horford. And he played for many years and had, I think, probably several teams. And, you know, it isn't like he couldn't play. But I think everybody saw this incredible potential that was potentially a Hall of Fame body, but didn't have that push. Now, I could be telling the story. I may not be being fair to Tito. Maybe he worked harder than I know. But I think the story was there was a lot of frustration that Tito Horford, had he worked as hard as the average NBA player, he would have been really special. Ironically, his son, Al Horford, is a tremendous, tremendous worker and did not get his dad's body. So Al is 6'10". He's not 7'2". And but Al Horford has been an all-star. He's been an extraordinarily hard worker all his life in basketball, won a couple of para-national championships at University of Florida with Joakim Noah. And there's a third amigo of the three I'm forgetting. Point is that you couldn't talk it out of Al Horford. And this person is kind of, hey, you know, just not that stressed, don't feel that inspired, just sort of moments of inspiration come and go in an instant. Well, I have no advice for you. I look around the world for me personally and see more inspiring things than I will ever have a chance to do anything about. That's me. So I'm doing what I can do. It's as feebly or well as I can. And many people are that way. And many people are get to a place where they're comfortable and you know, all they want to do is, you know, lay in the sun, have a decent situation, you know, make love once in a while and watch their kids grow and all is cool. You know, they don't burn with anything greater than that. So as long as this person has pretty good life satisfaction, I'm not looking down at all. It's just a different nervous system than the nervous systems of someone who would not be comfortable in those situations without essentially watching their actions follow their passion that comes innately and naturally into the system. And that's how it is. I had a friend of mine who was a psychiatrist that was like this. This could have been written by him, that he was just relaxed, pleasant, had a good life, everything's cool, plenty of money, no need to do anything fancy, and just like to go home after work and play on his Xbox. I couldn't believe it. You know, just I would tell him about interesting things in the development of evolutionary psychology. He'd listen pleasantly for about 5 minutes, and then that was it. He was not interested in listening to anything more. And such is life. That's the life of my friend the doctor, as opposed to my life. And that's innate. That's innate to people. And God knows he probably gets just as much satisfaction out of his life as I get out of mine. But I would not be satisfied with his life, and he would be puzzled and confused by the efforts that I put in, just because it wouldn't make any sense to him. Not when there's a chaise lounge and a bunch of grapes. Why on earth are you doing anything? That's individual differences in people.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think, are there individual differences and genetic differences with regards to discipline ability?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Overwhelmingly, that's true. In fact, you know, this is not a bad departure to actually talk about some things that I've learned about individual differences in people, some things that I didn't know. I recently read a book called Blueprint. It was published last year by Robert Plomin. And Robert Plomin is one of the very narrow handful of grand old men of behavior genetics. So he's one of our great living scientists. And he says point blank that in the book that he wanted to publish this book 30 years ago, but he says – he didn't do it out of cowardice because behavior genetics is the ultimate of anti-PC. it doesn't get any worse for political correctness than behavior genetics. So the but Plowman has finally published the summa of his career, and there are several eye-opening insights in the book that I had and also mistakes, you know, misunderstandings that I had had. And one of the there are a few, so I'll summarize a few things. Plowman explains that the evidence indicates that essentially 100% of the systematic variation about your intelligence or your personality is genetic. So he doesn't actually, he doesn't say that in exactly those terms, but that's what it's, that's precisely what's being said. It's 100% of what we're going to call the systematic variation. In other words, can we see, it winds up being half of the variance of what it is that you measure. So let me explain why. So the people on the other side, the sort of loyal opposition over there in learning theory and dynamic land, are going to say, oh, well, half of it's genetic and half of it's environment. And that would be an incorrect characterization of what the data is demonstrating. Let's suppose we have two monozygotic twins and we're tracking anything about them, how happy they are, how conscientious they are, how depressed they are, how honest they are. As we watch them, we see that they are extremely similar. But when we measure, for example, how happy they are on June 27th of their 23rd birthday, one of them, John, is quite a bit happier than Pete. Okay? Now, and in fact, we may even measure them, we may measure that again, 16 months later, and it's also true that John is happier than Pete. And so this would say, well, they are not exactly the same on this measure, and since they're not exactly the same, it's clearly not entirely genetic. So therefore, the environment is responsible, which is true in principle. But here's the problem, that this would, from an environmentalist perspective, this would be the idea that John is inherently happier than Pete because of a history of things that have happened, and therefore has biased his nervous system through some process to be, you know, he's learned to be happier, he's learned to be more adaptive, he's learned this or he's learned that, he's become this or he's become that. That is not what the data indicates. What it indicates is that all of the variation that is not captured by the genetics winds up being entirely unpredictable. So there is no system to it. So John isn't consistently happier than Pete. He's just happier at time one. At time two, he may be happier or he may be less happy, but it's completely unpredictable at time two who's going to be happier between the pair. In other words, there is no systematic variance. When you raise two monozygotic twins apart and you have a cold, rejecting, alcoholic, nasty, gnarly, punishing father in the one house, and then you have a warm, loving, supportive, wonderful, you know, it's a father and mother in the other house, there is no systematic difference in those personalities as they become adults. None. There is no difference in how warm, supportive, pleasant either one of those are. It is 50-50. Okay, if you had to say on the score sheet which one is going to seem calmer and more pleasant today, it would not be the one that came out of the pleasant household. There would be no, it would be literally a coin flip. Okay, in other words, there's no systematic process by which environmental inputs are causing changes in the personality or the intelligence of humans. Okay. This is incredible. This is literally one of the greatest discoveries in the history of social science. And yet it is so counterintuitive, so difficult for people to swallow. that it's literally remains obscured even in modern textbooks. Plowman very clearly makes this case, and he has a few phrases to encapsulate this message. He says, for example, parenting is important, but it doesn't make any difference. What he's saying is that you lived 15, 20 years with your parents. So if your parent is a disagreeable pain in the neck and lies to you and is abusive, hey, it's important in the fact that you had a lousy existence as a result of that. But it won't make any difference in your personality. It's not going to make any difference at all in your personality. It just meant that those years were lousy. If you had a wonderful parent, it's like that doesn't make any difference at all when it comes to your personality, but you had a much better existence. So is parenting important? It's enormously important. Is the environment important? It is enormously important. But it won't change fundamentally who it is that you are at all. That's what he means. 100% of who it is that you are, that is genetic. What's happening in your life is an interaction between what that genetic mechanism is and your environment. So, of course, if you're a parent or you're a coach or you're a teacher or you're a counselor, of course it matters what you do because it's making a difference in terms of that individual's existence, but it's not changing them. So this completely turns the tables upside down on both learning theory and psychodynamic, which is essentially its own twist on learning theory, versions of human psychological development. So if you're a Freudian dynamic-oriented psychologist and someone comes into you who's anxious and depressed, your thinking is, what underlying troubles, someone is a real terrible worrywart, what happened back in your early childhood? What were the object relations, i.e. the relationships between you and your parents and significant others that caused you to feel like you didn't live in a secure world and therefore you made this, we've twisted your nervous system up to be like this? No, it didn't make any difference at all. If you have an anxious, depressed, worrywart, that's genetic. That's what they are. Now, the question is, if you're a psychotherapist, what can we do to change the current circumstances to deactivate those instincts from being so, you obviously are being consistently sort of overwhelmed by the challenges in your current circumstances. What can we do to modify the current circumstances? Not what can we do to change you and go back and heroically reparent and recall the abusive, cowering crap that you had to put up with that turned you into who it is that you are today. No, it didn't turn you into what you are today. There is no, quote, reparenting, reorganizational process that a human being can go through because those events did not influence that person's personality. This is what Plowman shows, and it's checkmate. There's no doubt that this is the way it is. The another thing that I learned from Plowman, these things I already knew, and you guys have heard me say this stuff before, but now I'm more vehement because I hadn't actually looked into the behavior genetics data in quite a long time. The reason is that I was aware of half a dozen fairly major studies all pointing to exactly the same, very similar looking coalition coefficients. So there was no doubt in my mind, and there was nowhere for learning theory or dynamic developmental theory to go. So I've been done with this question since 1992. However, I also knew that I didn't know that much about the field. So I knew that, it's not like you're hearing every other week about how adverse childhood experiences cause this and cause that. So, I've been less than totally arrogant about this. maybe just a hair. However, now that I've read Plowman, I was concerned for, you know, if your view is on half a dozen super well-designed studies, you know you're on super solid ground and nothing's going to tip that over. But you don't know what slot might come to light, and there might be significant sources of variance that we didn't quite see. Frank Soloway, who's a heck of a thinker, had really thought that birth order might have significant effects on how adventurous and defiant young men would be if they were in the second order, as opposed to be the first in the order, because they needed to leave their father's businesses because they weren't going to be the one, et cetera. So I read that, and it's a book called Born to Rebel. It was a major effort to try to understand human psychological development. And Soloway really thought that he had something, and it turned out he didn't. It's all bogus. It was all just what it looked like, a bunch of anecdotal, deep thinking by a fine scholar looking for a pattern and in the end finding nothing that was true. Now, what I didn't know is that I knew the original Minnesota study of monozygotic twins raised apart, that the beautiful evidence that came in early in the mid-80s was 92 twin pairs, I believe. And there's enough studies. Those have enough statistical power. The effect sizes are huge. It's very clear. It's been not much has ever been found for environmental effects on the development of personality, and the genetics have been huge. That's what the story has been. But now I find out that quietly, like a bunch of termites, behavior geneticists around the world have compiled a phenomenal amount of data. In fact, so it's not 92 twin pairs or 116, it's 15 million. 15 million twin pairs have been studied in the last three decades. And they have published over 2,700 scientific studies. This is how it is. Behavior genetics shouldn't even be called behavior genetics. It should be called personality. All other theories of personality are wrong and totally useless. And not only that, they're harmful to be as data out there in the world as naive clinicians continue to sprout this stuff and lead people all over the place in ways that are non-productive. Behavior genetics is personality. That's the story. Now, one last thing I'll tell you from Plowman, and you can read it for yourself and enjoy the feast. There's more in there that I'm going to tell you, but there's another thing that I did not know, and I was just really pleased to learn, because I just didn't know. I think we've had this question asked on the podcast before, and I was mistaken in my understanding. I believed that there was such a thing called that we're going to call psychopathology, and that you could have openness to experience, for example, on a dimension, but openness to experience and instability, you know, if you got super open, you're pretty wacky. You believe in all kinds of stuff. And if you're super unstable, hey, you know, then you're really open and really unstable. Okay. That could be a pretty wacky looking human, but I didn't understand that things like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, they are not apart from these bell curves. They are just on the bell curve. Now, I had been making that argument with respect to personality disorders. So, you know, you've heard me say that a psychopath is just a disagreeable, low conscientious human. It's just a combination of those things. A narcissist is not a, quote, narcissistic personality disorder. That's just a very disagreeable person. A borderline personality disorder isn't some haywire thing that went wrong in development about connection with some parent. No, a borderline personality disorder is just a name we give to people for people who are disagreeable and unstable. Okay, so that had been my conviction, that in personality disorders, I was convinced that there wasn't something, quote, haywire beyond nothing other than bell curves on personality dimensions. Plowman enlightened me that it goes for everything. It doesn't stop there. That's what schizophrenia is. There isn't a place where you sit at the 98th percentile on that dimension and you are fine. And then if something wiggles in your life and you slip and you kind of hit your head, that now we tip you over the 99th percentile and now you're schizophrenic and you're crazy. No, it's all on the bell curve. That there is no slippery slope out there. And the problem is another major thing, a huge discovery, was that I expected that there would be a few genes that would be responsible. So one of my professors in grad school was Professor Irvin Gottesman, who was probably the leading figure in mid to late century investigations in the genetics of schizophrenia. And Gottesman finally came to the conclusion that he thought that it was, you know, some X number of genes, a handful, and that's probably what was responsible. That's why you saw this huge familial influence that he discovered, but you did not, it didn't fall in lines like brown eyes, blue eyes. It wasn't simple Mendelian genetics. It was messier than that, and a lot messier, and therefore he thought, you know, there could be 5-10 genes. It turns out there are thousands. It's not 5 or 10. So if you're measuring any characteristic like conscientiousness, like openness to experience, like intelligence, like craziness, you're not looking at a few genes. You're looking at 5,000 genes. 5,000 genes determines where you are on the bell curve. This is incredible. This means you can't find some master control switch for a gene for bipolar disorder, which incidentally is essentially the same characteristics. It's the same genes and the same problem as schizophrenia. So what was once thought as a major distinction between two major classes of psychiatric problems, i.e. bipolar dementia versus schizophrenia, no, it turns out that it's the same genes. So you got subtly different manifestations at different times, et cetera. Now, and it's on a bell curve issue of gene concentrations, et cetera. This is really interesting, and it's important for us to know, and it also pretty well checkmates the pharmaceutical industry for coming up with a solution, because you're not looking for one little thing to – one little gene that affects one neurotransmitter, that if we shut that down or get it regulated, we're going to fix the problem. No, you're not. Okay? Not when there's 5,000 to 10,000 genes associated with this particular characteristic. There's no way for that to happen. So this is an extraordinary document, blueprint, and it's the documentation of these, some of these major essentially evolution of our understanding of what the behavior genetics data was suggesting in some ways, you know, 30 years ago and further, but now it's reached a crescendo. So now we know much more than we knew 20 years ago. We know that there are thousands of genes involved with a single dimension. We know that what we call the abnormal is simply normal. It's simply part of the normal curve. We know that what you're observing when you're observing these things is genetic and not subject to environmental influence of any particular, you know, except for very short-term little perturbations, as we would talk about our monozygotic twins. John might be happier the first two times we measure him, but the third time he's not. 2 years later, his girlfriend dumped him. Pete's got a new girlfriend, and now Pete's happier. So, in other words, it's random variation that is what's causing the lack of precision. That's why you can't just get somebody's genes coded and say, oh, well, I know that you're super happy and super stable and everything's great for you right now. No, you may have very good happy genes and good stable genes, but things could be shit for you right now because your environment is in real trouble. Okay. So, but what will happen is when that trouble passes, your personality will undoubtedly return to spend most of its life at the baseline that it was designed by nature to be in. So, all things being halfway equal, you will have a very stable, happy life if those were the genes that you were given. So, this is the extraordinary confidence and precision that now come out of behavior genetics. Plowman did not say this the way that I'm saying it. Personality theory has been discussed forever, and has been seen as a mishmash. Is a grudging concession to the data from behavior genetics. Has been seen as a nature and nurture combination. This is not true. We now have the answer to the understanding of personality, and 100% of the variants. God knows we can't say that, because if you have a hammer fall and hit you on the head, we've now done brain damage, and so therefore your experiences may well influence your personality. Let's just point out that essentially all of the systematic variance that is measurable in the human personality is due to the genes. So that's the story from the grand old professor, Robert Plowman, and with huge implications for psychiatry, clinical psychology, and even though he doesn't say it, politics, economics, all kinds of things fall from this. The world is going to have to choke down these realities. They're not going to have a choice for the reason that one last thing that I will explain that Plowman explained is that up to now, there's been a space in the science that has allowed the wiggle room of inference for people who are not mathematically inclined or interested to follow the logic of behavior genetics. And that is, okay, well, you measured the twins, and then, yeah, you tell me that they've got the same genes, but, you know, well, I can't see the genes, and I don't know what they are, so I'm not so sure that that's really the reason, okay? That's sort of the, I don't want to hear it, or I'm not smart enough, or I don't want to think that clearly, and believe me, all of that goes on at the highest level of social science. That lack of clarity and lack of respect and lack of willingness to focus and essentially acknowledge what the evidence demonstrates. However, that's over. That's over because now they can actually cheaply enough with a crashing cost, they're now able to actually measure the genes directly. So now there is simply all of the psychological testing that has ever been done in the world is now currently defunct. It is a dinosaur. There's no reason for an IQ test at all. All we need to do is just get your genetic profile and we can tell. There's no reason to take, you know, to have a personality inventory like the MMPI. God forbid. Throw out the whole idea of anybody taking a Rorschach, which is a useless piece of garbage. But we're talking about the MMPI, for God's sake, the most respected personality instrument in the world. There's no reason for it, okay? We can now measure the genes directly. We know what you are. We know how emotionally stable you are. We can tell. You're right there at the 69th percentile because you've got these genes. We've got the 5,677 genes mapped, and we know how many of them you've got. And we know that the ones that are influential all have similar amount of influence. Each gene has about 1/100th of 1% of the influence on the phenotype. It's unbelievable. Tiny little influences. So we don't even have to worry about which of those 5,377 genes you've got. Whatever the ones you've got, we can chart it, and we know who you are. We know how smart you are. We know how stable you are. We know how open to experience you are. We know how introverted or extroverted you are. We know how disagreeable you are. In fact, we know you. That it's no longer necessary to do intermediary tests. This is unbelievable. So this is the end of any objections in the social sciences to behavior genetics. It's over. So psychologists will now, what's that?
It's pretty profound implications, politically speaking, because, I mean, someone who's just genetically lower ability, to date, they've just been bluffing their way through life, they may scream really loud at not wanting these things published, right?
Sure. There could be a lot of reasons. It's going to get this, you know, it's going to get hot in this kitchen. So you can believe that the extraordinary anti-PC flavor that comes with behavior genetics is going to be in the next, you know, 10 to 15 years, this is going to be extraordinary to watch humanity deal with this knowledge. It just turns out by chance that we could have chosen a better spokespeople than Robert Plumman, who's still young enough to be able to speak up and elucidate, you know, the realities of this situation. Plumman is tall, handsome, well-spoken. He's also, amazingly enough, far left politically. And so as a result, he's a guy that has cringed when he's been called a Nazi for what it is that he's found. And he feels, you know, just like a true person of science committed to the truth. He's simply followed his nose to the truth. And here he's laying it out for us. He and now an awful lot of other people. This is the new realities. This is what's going to happen pretty soon. What's coming is people figuring out what your profile is and now knowing how to sell you, you know, what it is that would be the easiest thing to sell you. So they're sort of doing that now, but it's going to get way better in the years to come. And this isn't necessarily particularly creepy. You know, I would just soon be pitched by companies that know what it is that I'm inherently looking for, rather than by companies that don't have any idea. And so the world is going to get more focused and waste less energy when it comes to trying to put in front of people the products and services and things that they actually are genetically drawn to. And fine, you know, it's been done crudely up to now. That's what the Wall Street Journal is versus the National Enquirer, okay? But it's going to get better, and it's going to get extremely precise as a result of the fact that behavior genetics is true, and also the fact that it can be measured with precision. So it will be fascinating. I will get to have the satisfaction in the last third of my life watching this reality, which, you know, I've been aware of and have been in an extreme minority of social scientists that has been willing to openly acknowledge this truth and have been disagreeable enough and conscientious enough to not waver. And so this is how it is, folks. And it's important for us to know it. What's that?
Good luck to
What's
us
that?
Highly open people.
The thing is that as a clinician, this is invaluable. So, you know, if the clinicians would open their minds to this, when you're staring at somebody with their issues, understand you're looking, you know, partly at their circumstances and enormously at their genetic code. And if you recognize that, you can be more effective at the advice and direction that you give them, because once you understand that the reason why they are the way they are is because that's how they are, that starts changing, you know, the clinician's frustration with how it is that we're going to fix you so that you're more like a person in the middle of the bell curve when you're not. Mm-hmm. Instead, we start figuring out how to adapt your strategies to figure out how we're going to find an ecological niche for you that fits your particular genotype better. That's what we're going to want to do with a great many problems in clinical psychology.
Fascinating. The name of the book is Blueprint, How DNA Makes Us Who We Are by Robert Plumman. Don't be confused. There's another book that comes up at the top when you search Blueprint on, say, Google or Amazon or something like that. It's another book by the same name that just came out 3 months ago, so that maybe they might have an intellectual property fight going on. But this is Blueprint, How DNA Makes Us Who We Are by Robert Plumman.
Fabulous.
Dr. Lyle.
All right, sir.
All right, Dr. Lyle. Well, fascinating information as always. We will look forward to talking with everybody next week. Dr. Lyle, thanks so much and have a wonderful, wonderful holiday coming up here.
All right. Thank you, Nate. We'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.